This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, I'm Cassie with you for The Country Hour today across South Australia and Broken Hill. Well, if you're in the cattle game, could today be the day that the Eastern Young cattle indicator cracks 900 cents? One analyst thinks so.
The recent rain in the north of Australia has made it harder for some cattle to get to market, so the buying might be a little more frenzied, and the fact that it's also put a lot more grass on the ground, so it's given people a bit of green fever to do a bit more buying today. Let's take a punt on that and say that it does hit it sometime this week, but don't get worried that it will stay there forever.
Great if you're selling, not so good if you're buying. It's not easy restocking at the moment. I'll have more on what the EYCI is doing and take a look at what the viticulture industry is doing to improve its biosecurity as well. But first up today, shipping disruptions and port congestion is still wreaking havoc on the global wool trade, with one leading industry figure saying that Australian packing houses are at breaking point. And in the latest development, the Port of Kolkata has introduced a congestion tax of $500 US per shipping container. Rural reporter Angus Furley spoke with Fox and Lily brokerage manager Eamon Timms, who says it's an unprecedented time for the wool industry.
Angus, I don't know if we've ever seen the logistics of the industry pushed as hard as they are at the moment. It's a really challenging time for people handling wool. So, you know, as an example, if you've got to get, say, 100 bales to a particular wool pack for a wool dump over, you know, 3 days this week, often the broker would just load up their truck with 100 bales and send it around there. But now the dumps are saying, we can't accept all this week's wool at once. We want the bales, we want on the 20 bales we want on Tuesday, we want the 30 bales we want on Wednesday, and we want the 50 bales we had ordered on Thursday to be delivered physically on Thursday. So you can see the efficiency of people in the industry now has been impacted. You know, trucks are making 3 trips over 3 days instead of 1 trip in 1 day, and that's always just been normal practice. And you know, the dumps are just under this enormous pressure because they've got containers banking up. So you've got, you know, wool and containers there that are not moving as quickly as usual. So you can see that the bind that, that they're in, and obviously, you know, the whole shipping crisis, which, you know, we've been talking about for a while, is now really pushing back and impacting on this end of the business.
So does it purely boil down to a lack of ships on the water?
Purely, yeah, down to that lack of ships on the water. So reduced sailing schedules, it's just putting enormous pressure on things. And fortunately, there's a lot of direct sailings from the eastern states of Australia to China. So the China situation, not as badly impacted. It's a little bit slower, but not significantly slower. But when you start talking wool to other parts of the world, India and Europe, etc., it's a real headache because that must go via another port. And if you look at, you know, Port Kelang in Malaysia or Singapore or Colombo in Sri Lanka, all those ports are absolutely congested like they've never been before. And we're seeing, you know, some ports now starting to impose congestion taxes. So Calcutta in India, if you're shipping wool to an Indian client, and Calcutta, as of the last week, put a $500 US tax on every 20-foot container that was going into that port. So you can still ship wool to India via Nhava Sheva, where it doesn't have a congestion tax, but you haven't got as many vessels going to that port. So this whole shipping thing has presented a minefield for people at the moment.
So if you take all of those factors, Eamon, that lack of ships, that lack of efficiency, those increased shipping costs, things like that congestion tax you mentioned, who's bearing those costs, and are they eventually going to be passed on to the farmer through the wool price they receive?
At the moment, the exporter's been shouldering a lot of that cost, and I suppose time will tell whether that, you know, flows back through the market to the price being paid in the sale room. But, you know, we're fortunate at the moment to have fairly robust demand coming through from China is still taking, you know, 85 to 90% of the wool clip, and so that's, you know, that's a good thing in terms of this shipping situation and, you know, the freight situation. So the freight to China hasn't really changed a lot in terms of getting a container up there, but you can see that they're pretty keen to get as many containers back to China as quickly as they can. So there's a lot of empty containers going from Australia back to China now. You know, they can get up to, say, $9,000 for a container going out of China and into Europe, which, you know, Fox Mill just experienced because they had to move some wool they processed at one of their mills in China up to Europe. And that's more than twice what it would cost a year ago to move that wool top from China into Europe. So you can see the those challenges are there, and I suppose if it goes on, if it keeps going on at this rate, we'll probably start to see it reflected in pricing as we go forward.
Just finally, Eamon, we should address what's happening in the Suez Canal with the Evergreen, that container ship blocking the canal. You touched on this. Lots of processed wool and also garments go from China to Europe through the canal. Also, greasy wool goes from Australia to Europe through the canal. Have you heard of that having any impact on any of those shipments at this point?
Angus, you're right. It's a very significant route with 12% of world trade going through the Suez Canal. At this point, speaking to the shipping side at Fox and Lily Export, we haven't seen any impact on any wool, either greasy wool or wool tops, but it's all going to depend on how long this crisis goes for, because obviously if they'll have to reroute ships around the Cape of Good Hope, then, you know, you're looking at another 10 days and a lot more fuel, and obviously it will increase the freight rates again, another increase in freight rates.
Eamon Timms, Wool Brokerage Manager for Fox and Lily Rural, speaking to Angus Verley. If you've had trouble getting your wool to market or issues with the storage and packing houses, I'd be interested to hear your experience. Text me 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. Eamon Timms was saying there, unprecedented time for the industry. So we'd be interested to see how far back that is affecting people, whether it's getting all the way back to people on farms. Moving from sheep to cattle, though, the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator looks set to climb past the 900-cent mark. Can you believe it? 900 cents for the first time in its history, as those restockers and feedlotters continue to show an insatiable demand for the stock. And obviously the rain around hasn't hurt that either. The EYCI closed at 896 cents a kilogram carcass weight yesterday, surging past the record that was set in January of 888.25 cents a kilogram. Rural reporter Angus Verley spoke with Michael Whitehead, who is the head of Agribusiness Insights at ANZ Bank, who says it's really been an extraordinary period for cattle prices.
So I think there's every chance it could hit the 900-cent mark. It's being so close to it. Fascinating to think if we go back to the start of 2020, it was sitting on that 500-cent mark. We saw it shoot up to the mid-700s in 6 months and then go through 800 and then get to where it is now. So intriguing to watch that rise in a reasonably short amount of time.
And as you said, only around 12 months ago when it was less than 500 cents, I think everyone foresaw that it was going to rise substantially, but do you think people expected it to rise to this extent?
I think people probably didn't, and a lot of industry observers have watched it, and every month people have predicted it would be the start of the downturn and the start of the downturn, but it's continued to grow up, to rise steadily. It's a slower rise now than it has been perhaps earlier in the middle of 2020. So it's definitely slowed down, but it's still going up. And clearly a sign that the restocking is continuing to happen, and people are continuing to pay what they need to get cattle onto their places.
I was looking earlier at some figures from Thomas Elder Markets, looking at the all-time high for young cattle prices in inflation-adjusted terms. I think they'd come out with a figure at about 936 cents a kilogram back in 1965. So if we're looking at an all-time high taking inflation into account, could we pass that figure, that 936 mark?
Well, it's interesting, and that's a very good point in terms of whether we look at an all-time all-time high, and we bring in those different factors to go back through history. Or, on the other hand, we could look at this as a cycle, and definitely part of a cycle, and then go back through previous cycles to get an idea of where we're going. And if we go back over cycles for the last 10 years or so, as impressive as this may seem, reaching these heights, we only have to go back to about the period between 2015 and 2017 to see what was a pretty spectacular rise at the time then, going from 300 cents on the ECI to above 700 cents. And that was absolutely a period where a lot of people in the industry will remember. We were thinking, when are these prices going to stop? What's going to be the impact here? But ultimately, they did, and they started a steady correction. So this cycle, like every other, is different, but it is another cycle, and it will follow that same path at some point.
Okay, so just on that point, what happens through the winter months? Where will prices go?
Well, this all depends so much on the actions of producers, and we all know that there's a number of factors driving this up, but the biggest one is rebuilding everybody's herd and restocking. And the rain has continued to be there, or the growing conditions have also continued to be good. So growers are continuing to make those decisions to restock. They're looking at the fact they don't need to be spending as much on feed as they would have in the past. So it takes that factor out. And really looking to see just what level it will be when they get their herd to a position and the prices they'll be happy to pay until they think that fits best with their strategy. We would think, and I think a lot of industry observers would think, that the restocking probably won't go on for that much longer, and then things will start to level out to a degree.
And of course it is both those restockers and also the feedlotters driving up young cattle prices at the moment. Not ideal for them, of course, to be buying at the top of the market, but if they need to buy at the moment, they've got no choice. But are they going to make money if they are paying such a top dollar at the moment? Are they going to be able to convert that into a profit?
We need to look at this as a longer-term game, and remember we are dealing with a group who are very clever and know what they're doing in the meat industry. They'll be looking at, yes, the squeeze is going to be very tight right now, but they're going to be looking at what is that demand going to be domestically for their meat going forward, what's going to be the availability of cattle coming onto the market with spring calving and going forward from that, and they're going to be looking at those export markets and thinking, we know exports are tight right now, but how do we see them going in 2022 and further from that?
And talking about export markets, I think Australian cattle is some of the most highly priced in the world. So once that restocker demand dissipates, will there be a sharp correction to bring Australian prices in line with some of its international competitors?
Look, if you look at history and if you look back over Australian cattle prices, while there is a history of corrections from those highs, it's not necessarily a sharp one. You take the factors once again into account for the export market. Yes, if the restocking slows down, there will be more cattle available for processing and more beef available for exports as well. People talk about the impact of currency at the moment and the Australian dollar sitting at around 76 US cents at the moment, higher than people thought it would be a year ago. But in the long term, it's a factor that producers and exporters get used to, so that's not necessarily a deterrent. Things will become more competitive on the world market. Australian beef will become more competitive with South American beef, with US beef as well. But I think one big factor to remember, if we worry that we may get shut out or lose a big market share of particularly our four key markets, is that it is in these countries, the US, Japan, South Korea and China, to have a diversified range of countries they import beef from, so they will continue to want Australian beef. And when everything else comes to the table, we still, and we've been saying it for years, if not decades, we still export a premium product that is barely matched in all its features by any other beef exporting country in the world.
Just finally, Michael, to return to where we began, the indicator only needs to rise 4 cents today to crack that 900 cents barrier for the first time. Does it happen today?
Okay, you're putting me on the spot, and I'm going to have a small wager that it might, because even other factors, if some of the recent rain in the north of Australia has made it harder for some cattle to get to market, so the buying might be a little more frenzied, and the fact that it's also put a lot more grass on the ground, so it's given people a bit of green fever to do a bit more buying today. Yep,
let's take a punt on that and say that it does hit it sometime this week, but don't get worried that it will stay there forever.
Michael Whitehead, the head of Agribusiness Insights at ANZ, speaking with Angus Verley, taking a bit of a punt there on whether or not the EYCI could reach 900 cents. It was only about 4 years ago that everyone got excited about it reaching $5, so 500 cents. So it's certainly rocketed up in the last couple of years. It's 20 past 12 here on the Country Hour.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Weather's up next, but before then, working with individual businesses is one of the key ways the wine industry's biosecurity body is going to tackle issues of biosecurity going forward. And to do that, VineHealth Australia has outlined a new strategic plan for the next 5 years. CEO Inka Lee says the first target is the biosecurity solutions across the wine supply chain.
It's all very well and good for us to, you know, encourage growers and winemakers to adopt best practice farm gate hygiene. But if they don't have practical solutions to do that, adoption will remain low. So we're very focused on making sure that we have practical solutions that growers and winemakers and also contractors and suppliers to the wine industry can adhere to. The second area is really about industry ensuring that we can minimise the impacts of pests, making sure that they've got systems in place that if we were to get a pest to come in, like phylloxera or xylella, they can respond quickly and we can contain and eradicate and minimise the social, the economic and the environmental impact of that pest. The third area really looks around industry working with government to help shape the regulatory environment. And by regulatory, I'm talking about all the movement conditions. So it's ensuring that that regulatory environment is effective, it's efficient, and ultimately protects the industry from the introduction of pests. The fourth area is biosecurity. We're only as strong as our weakest link. So that's about working together, having a very strong interconnected network and working in partnership with government, with growers, with winemakers, and everyone right along that great supply chain. And finally, the fifth area is really about VineHealth delivering systems to industry that enable them to put biosecurity action into place. And one of the key pillars of this is a new digital biosecurity platform that we're hoping to evolve our current vineyard register to. Growers will have access to their digital vineyard maps. They'll get up-to-date and very timely information on any outbreaks, preparedness activities they need to do, and also prevention.
So how would this digital biosecurity platform differ from the programs that are already in place to combat that?
Currently at the moment we have a vineyard register that we maintain of all vineyards across the state, and it's a very static register in that growers can't actively use the information in that to inform their decisions. And this new digital biosecurity platform will use technology to take it to the next level so that growers can log in onto a portal, they can visualise their vineyards, and then they can receive updated information. And it also provides a platform that they can explore other ag tech opportunities as well. One of the other benefits, other than biosecurity, is we know that there are a lot of prescribed burns that take place in the state, and we see the digital biosecurity platform also as enabling that prescribed burn process to happen in conjunction and not compromise grapes when they're unharvested.
Back on the first target that you mentioned, you said that there was a target to achieve a stronger and an active defence against pests. You mentioned that there would be solutions for that. What solutions would that look like?
There's many and varied. It can be as simple as providing a footwear solution onto vineyards. So we ask, you know, when visitors come to a vineyard that they disinfect their shoes. At the moment, that means standing in chlorine for 60 seconds, which is difficult in some situations. Why don't we have a practical solution that can be an overshoe that is fit for purpose for the wine industry? It doesn't break when you walk over canes or rock in the vineyard into rows. It's very simple, practical solutions. It can also be electronic signing sheets for visitors so that we can help with traceability in the future. We're talking very practical. We're not talking grand systems. It's down at the grassroots level to provide very basic solutions for growers and winemakers.
In the second target you mentioned, you said that it's really about preparation so that if there is an incursion with a pest, you can respond to it quickly. What would that preparation look like?
Yeah, look, I think simulations. I think we've all been through a pretty tumultuous period over the last year with COVID, and we've all seen front and centre what a disease impact could be on a community in terms of movement restrictions, impacts on business. And that analogy holds for a pest incursion in the wine industry. We would see significant restrictions on the movement of grapes and the movement of machinery and equipment. Through this priority area, we're really seeking to work hand in hand with industry to run them through simulations, run them through the plans that we have if we were to have an outbreak, and say, what are the gaps? What are you not prepared for if we had a phylloxera incursion tomorrow? How can you better your systems now to ensure that you minimise the impact on your people, on your profitability, on the sustainability of your organisation, and also the community? Grape and wine businesses are a huge part of the regional economy. A pest impact will spread far and wide.
Vine Health Australia CEO Inka Lee speaking to Bridget Herman there. We'll find out what's happening weather-wise, because it looks like it's warming up. Senior forecaster Brett Gage at the Bureau of Meteorology has more, though. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie.
What's happening with this weather?
Yeah, we've got a high-pressure system of about 1,027 hectopascals centred over western Victoria, and that high is going to remain near stationary for a couple of days, and then it will move gradually eastwards to be over the Tasman Sea on Friday. So as that high moves away, winds will tend more northerly, and as you mentioned, temperatures will climb into the start of Easter. We had some areas of morning fog over Kangaroo Island and southeastern parts of the state this morning. Pretty thick fog down at Mount Gambier with visibility down to 100 metres there. Expecting something similar for tomorrow morning. But otherwise, conditions will remain dry right through to Saturday. And then we could see some early fog in the same areas on Sunday and Monday mornings. But no precipitation is expected. We could see some very high fire dangers around sort of Friday and Saturday. But then we've got a weak change moving across the west and south of the state on Saturday, which will make temperatures a bit milder in those parts on Sunday and Monday. So a great Easter for people who want to go out camping and fishing, etc. Very nice conditions, but it will be on the hot side, temperatures well above average on Friday and Saturday, so be a bit careful if you're out there using your barbecues, etc.
Yeah, you've said it is above average. It does, I mean, 34 degrees or something in Adelaide on Saturday, was it? That seems remarkably hot for what is basically the start of April.
Yeah, that's right. That is well above average. It's a good 10 degrees above average, actually. So, so that's why I say be careful in that first part of Easter. And there will be some reasonable swell coming through on Sunday as well. So some swell of about 3 to 4 metres. So if you're down on those open ocean coasts, just take a little bit of care. That's a relatively high swell for this time of year, certainly not for winter, but for this time of year, take a little bit of care as well. But overall conditions really are quite nice.
Well, that does sound like it's shaping up to be a lovely long weekend for people who are wanting to get out and about and even perhaps visit the beach. It's almost swimming weather, Easter swimming. I can't believe that. Thanks for that, Brett.
You're welcome, Cass.
That was Brett Gage from the Bureau of Meteorology speaking there. In the far west of New South Wales, it's a pretty similar situation. The upper western's going to be sunny, a little bit of wind around. The temperatures will get down to 12 to 15 degrees, but the daytime temperatures will reach about 30 degrees. The lower western will also be sunny. There the nights will get down to about 11, but the daytime temperatures will reach about 30 degrees. Now, coming up in the next half hour, the wine industry has had so many blows, but if you actually look at what the stock situation is doing, it's actually not too bad. There's actually people are drinking more wine than there is actually wine around, or there's been a drawdown on stock. So I'll get into that in the next half hour. But right now it is coming up to 12:30.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff.
Hi, I am Cassie Huff. So glad you could join me today. You know your jalapenos from your habaneros? So soon I'm going to take you into the world of chili growing.
The really good thing about the chilies is they don't need a lot of water. We actually water our grass more than we water the chilies.
It's not something I partake in much. Not a big fan of chili, but a lot of people are. So I'll delve into to that world and see just what is being grown in Australia. Also, the Easter long weekend is a busy time for the seafood industry, especially on Australia's largest barramundi farm. They've just broken a record harvest for their barramundi. So good news if you're seeking some Australian barra this Friday. I'll have more on that soon. But first, we have to find out what's making news with Wendy Glamachek. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie. In the news this hour, South Australia's COVID-19 Transition Committee has met this morning and says while it's monitoring the situation in Queensland, it's not making changes to restrictions at this stage. Despite the coronavirus outbreak in Brisbane, density limits at indoor hospitality venues will still ease as planned, allowing 3 people per 4 square metres from tomorrow. Pubs, restaurants and cafes will also be allowed to operate at around 75% capacity, and churches and cinemas will be allowed 100% capacity as long as patrons wear face masks. The Mayor of Byron Bay, meanwhile, says his community is nervously waiting test results from the New South Wales North Coast in the wake of the latest outbreak of COVID-19 in Queensland. 8 new cases have been detected in Queensland overnight, including 5 people who attended a party in Byron Bay at the weekend. And ships are once again moving through the Suez Canal after a huge container vessel that blocked the waterway for nearly a week was refloated. The Ever Given's been hauled to a lake between the north and south sections of the canal. More ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Gosh, it's been something else watching that ship get dislodged and then dislodged and the little excavator doing the job there. It's been such an interesting exercise to watch what was happening there, and the flow-on effects have been huge as well, so it's good that they are able to get that out. As I mentioned just before, we are going to be talking chilies later in the program. I would love to know, what's the hottest chili you've ever eaten? Did you have to build up your tolerance to be able to handle it, or were you just born with that ability? I was not born with that ability, and I grew up on very much a meat and 3 veg diet, so anything, even sweet chili sauce, is a bit of a stretch for me. So so if you're a bit braver than I am, text me 0467922891 or phone 1300 222 891. I'll have more on that soon. But first, what is some mixed news, good somewhat news for the wine industry? Australia's wine stocks are actually at their lowest point in 9 years. So a bit of confidence to the industry that's obviously suffered a number of blows in 2020. According to Wine Australia's Wine Production Sales and Inventory Report, Australian wine sales actually exceeded supply for the 3rd year in a row. So a bit of a drawdown there. But this latest stocks information doesn't take into account the changes to export markets like China in the last 9 months. It's really just for the 2019-2020 year. But Wine Australia's CEO Andreas Clark says that these survey results highlight the challenge that the wine sector is facing, that is the balance between supply and demand.
So, yeah, this report looks back over the last 12 months and takes a view as to the overall sorts of supply-demand balance. Now, it's important to note, obviously, that this predates the recent news out of China, which is obviously a heavy caveat to take note of. But overall, during the course of last year, you know, what we've seen, we've had successive low vintages, and we saw ongoing strong demand for Australian wine sales, both domestic and in a suite of markets in the course of the last 12 months, such that low sales exceeded supply for the 3rd year in a row, which is leading to the lowest stock-to-sales ratio in 9 years. You know, generally speaking, producers are obviously very much looking forward to this vintage, which is, by all reports, proving to be an outstanding vintage with the weather conditions in many parts of the country, and looking to refill the tanks so they've got some quality product to meet demand from their key customers around the world.
How much difference does this low stock situation make to the current concerns about exports for Australian wines?
Yeah, look, I think it certainly buys more time for the sector overall to adjust to the impact and the major disruption that the China situation presents for many in the industry. So it does give time to work through the issues. People were, as I said, were looking forward to getting product in, and so therefore they're going to hold on to many of their arrangements with growers. We are seeing a bit of dampening in some pricing for sure, but overall, anecdotally, what we're hearing is people are looking to get the product in, get the grapes in, and because they need to refuel the tanks. What's going to be interesting, obviously, over the next 12 months to see as the China impact starts to really bed down, how that plays through. So we won't know at this stage, but that's where we currently stand at the moment.
I understand this drawdown in stocks has affected white wine more than red wine?
But yes, look, there's different things, issues at play. White wine prices are holding up pretty strongly at the moment. We need to understand particularly, the China impact is principally a red wine issue because, 95, 96% plus of our exports to China were red wine. So we're seeing a red wine grape prices come off in a number of regions, but basically people have been short white wine and the prices have held up accordingly.
In the 2019-2020 period, which is the one we're talking about, demand outstripped supply, but it does seem like the domestic market is still decreasing in demand. Is that a concern?
Look, it's a lot of markets are moving towards slightly lower volumes but a higher value proposition. The long-term trends of moderation and premiumisation continue in key mature wine markets around the world, including Australia. So ultimately, I think that's a good thing. We want people to be prepared to move up the value chain. We want people, obviously, to be consuming wine responsibly. That's a key component for us. So I think that all holds up, really well, and that's a trend that we're well placed to tap into in the key markets across the globe.
You mentioned that people are quite excited about this year's vintage, that the cooler season has led to some really good quality. What effect do you think that's going to have on this trend that you're seeing with the greater consumption than production?
Well, look, I think many people were looking forward to getting some high yields, and it's always getting that great balance between getting more product in of the right quality. And I think if you can reach that sweet spot, which many are attesting to that's playing out at the moment, well, that's a great position to be in. So, we do produce brilliant wines, obviously, in Australia, and it continues that narrative that we can really take to our key customers across the world. So I think that plays to our strength. Obviously, then businesses need to make sure they understand where their opportunities sit, both domestically and in a suite of export markets.
Wine Australia CEO Andreas Clark speaking there. Now, are you getting ready for your Easter long weekend food? It's always a very busy time for the seafood industry, and at Humpty Doo Barramundi in the Northern Territory, which is Australia's largest barra farm, they've actually just broken a record. They harvested 110 tonnes of the fish in 1 week. Matt Brand spoke to the farm's Dan Richards about the big job of meeting the Easter orders.
So, Easter week, it tends to be the biggest week for fish sales in the year. And this year has been no exception. So our previous record was about 105 tonnes. And this year we did 110 tonnes over the last week. So our teams in harvest and packing have been working extra days over the last week to get that product all, harvested, chilled down, packed to the customer specifications, and it's all on its way to the interstate markets now.
When's the deadline to meet the Easter sales for you guys?
So basically, the fish that left the farm on Thursday, that Thursday was really our big day. That's all getting into the interstate markets today on the Monday. And so they've got a couple of days to get it all ready and in the market ready for, you know, Thursday is the last day of sales, of course, with the Friday, Easter Friday public holiday. So really the big wave's just gone past.
So in terms of the logistics of doing 110 tonnes of barramundi in a week, do you have to change much there at the farm to achieve it?
Oh, look, we've been running extra days, so you know, we can't put all that fish on in through the packed shed on one day. So we've had to run extra days to get that fish onto the slab and then you know, packed out and off again. So we'll be doing some upgrades this year so that we've got you know, more capacity coming into this Christmas.
Yeah, I guess a big part of the story out there is that you are expanding, and if all goes to plan, 110 tonnes a week almost becomes the norm, yeah? Or even a small week, potentially.
Absolutely, yeah. So by next year, we expect that sort of the sort of numbers we're looking at now will be the weekly average.
What's demand like in that if you had more fish, would it be easy to sell?
So this year, total industry production's down just a little, and so there, you know, right now there is more demand than we have fish available. Obviously, the expansion works that Humpty Doo Barramundi is doing to, you know, grow extra fish coming into the next year should get things back into balance a bit more. We're really aiming to make Australia much more self-sufficient in its barramundi supplies than it has been in the past.
Because we still import, what is it? It's 60%?
About 60%. So if you imagine nearly two-thirds of the barramundi that is consumed in Australia is imported. Australians really value a beautiful piece of barramundi more than just about any other market in the world. And so, you know, there's plenty of people who are happy enough to send fish in and possibly not label it as not being from Australia.
The Easter long weekend, what does it look like for you, Dan? Do you give yourself a bit of time off?
Well, I'm actually planning to do some fishing over the next couple of days, going to chase some barramundi, believe it or not.
Ones that aren't in ponds.
Yeah, that's right, just to mix it up, you know. So, going to get a little bit of fishing in and then, some family time, I hope.
Well, he's got the weather for it. Dan Richards from Humpty Doo Barra speaking. There is Barra on your plate this Easter. If you want to text me, 0467922891 or call 1300 222 891. I would be interested. Maybe some of the Barra you have is from the Humpty Doo Barramundi in the Northern Territory. Right now it is 17 minutes to 1.
Afternoons with Sonia Feldhoff.
Poultry farms will be required to be licensed. Peter Dolan is Director of Regulation at the EPA. Up until now, we have had no licensing requirements for poultry farms.
So currently, the EPA doesn't license poultry farms, and they're faced by regulation by different councils in different areas, and so there can be some variation across those things. So there'll be some more consistency in terms of the way they're regulated.
Sonia Feldhoff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hottest chilli you've ever had? Text me on 0467922891. I'd love to hear from people a little braver than I am when it comes to chillies. You can also call me on 1300 222 891 to tell me about whether or not you have developed a tolerance to some of those really hot chillies. If you have, maybe you're a bit like Northern Victorian farmer Neville Tonkin, who had never tried a chilli in his life until his partner Jude convinced him to sidestep from traditional farming and have a crack at growing jalapenos, habaneros and cayenne peppers. The pair say the hot, dry growing conditions at Fernahurst near Bort in northern Victoria has similar conditions to South America, which is a perfect environment for growing chilies. Eden Heinonen found out some more.
After spending two decades in the United States, Jude Hanna moved back to northern Victoria and wanted to recreate some of her favourite Mexican flavours. She decided to have a crack at growing chilies and was surprised at just how well they grew.
I put a couple of jalapeno plants in, and every time we picked it, we'd go back, you know, a week later and they'd be producing again and again and again. I just think we've got the right climate. I mean, if you have a look at our dry climate compared to, say, South America, Mexico, Central America and Spain, where and Asia, throughout Asia, our climates are very similar. But in the States, they grow most of their chilies in Arizona, which is arid desert conditions. The really good thing about the chilies is they don't need a lot of water. We actually water our grass more than we water the chilies.
Her partner, Neville Tonkin, has been a farmer in the region for decades. He decided to branch out from traditional farming and help Jude plant more than 1,800 chili plants, but at that time had never actually tasted a chili.
The jalapenos were the first that I tried, and they were quite hot for me. Being only a mild chili themselves, it was still quite hot for me, but now it's a breeze to pass a couple of those over the tongue. This is our fourth crop of producing chilies, predominantly just three main varieties of jalapenos and habaneros and cayenne, and we also have a line of capsicum which we use in our peri peri sauces. So we try to produce all what we put into our product ourselves, but the pineapples are a bit hard because they're a bit further north than here. Each bush or chili plant would probably yield around eight kilos in the season. You don't have to have many plants to have a lot of kilos available to process. Can't plant them until the frosts have taken up, which would be about October. So this year, with COVID in and not going away anywhere, we've got them in a lot earlier. So they started producing just before the new year started. So then they keep producing until the weather gets cold, and then once we get our first frost, the plants will die because they're not covered. Just mainly get the reddest ones, Jude.
Yeah.
Look, there's plenty underneath there.
Oh my gosh, look at the size of them there this year. They're huge, aren't they?
Yeah, you women.
Each chili variety has a different measurement of heat or Scoville scale, with cayenne peppers reaching about 50,000. Whereas some chilies, like the Carolina Reaper, reaching more than 1 million.
We did grow a couple of bushes, but
I did happen to try that once and it blew my head off.
No. So that is a really small market. So we felt that if we were going to be profitable in any way, that we had to target it towards a market that was going to eat the product, not just have it for a joke. So where the jalapenos? Jalapenos is probably a quarter of the way on the Scoville level. Cayenne's probably a bit under that, and then your habaneros are above, hotter again from the jalapenos. We're probably around three quarters of the way up on the Scoville level with the habaneros, and you certainly know it when you're chopping it up, even with gloves on. You can take your gloves off and your hands are numb with the burn.
You'll get that if you're not careful, and like Jude says, even the rubber gloves that you use don't seem to keep out all the heat, and you'll, if you're not careful, you'll get a bit in your eyes at some stage, and it stings a fair bit, so you just got to grin and bear it. Perhaps we should be producing into the capsicum spray market. See what we can do there.
Yeah. So many options. Neville Tonkin and his partner Jude Hanna ending that story from Eden Henenen. Now, I've had a text in from someone saying they're actually growing a variety called Inferno and they've just tried a 3 millimetre tip and my lips and tongue went numb. And that's from someone who loves chilies. I will not be trying the Inferno, I can guarantee you right now. But I wonder what it is on the Scoville scale. I thought that was interesting that there's actually a scale of heat. I wonder where your Inferno sits. Do keep texting me on your experience with chilies, because I'm interested to hear from people a bit braver than I am. Text on 0467922891 or phone 1300 222 891. Well, I'm talking about food. I guess this chili could come into this, but there's all sorts of future food trends, from people eating more white-fleshed fish and plant proteins, for example. They could be some of the big food trends of the future, according to the CSIRO, because a new report from the CSIRO has just looked at climate change playing a significant role in food production and how to try and find easier ways to farm. CSIRO Agriculture and Food Deputy Michael Robertson spoke to Jessica Schremer.
The big overwhelming trend is just this ongoing demand for food by a growing world population, and not only overall growing population, but a wealthier population who are demanding particularly more protein, particularly more animal protein, but also a growing market for plant protein as well. This is particularly in India and China and other fast developing Asian economies. So that's the big trend and the big opportunity for Australian farmers. There are other trends that are particularly more pertinent to wealthier consumers. So these are trends like people being more conscious about what they're eating, conscious about where it comes from, that it's produced on farms where farmers are doing the best they can to minimise harm to the environment, doing their best they can to treat animals ethically, all that sort of thing. So that's another trend. People are also becoming more conscious about what their food contains, and this rise of the flexitarian, which is the sort of term that's used now to refer to people who are trying to reduce the amount of meat that they consume.
Some of the growth areas that you have mentioned there are alternative proteins, but also aquaculture is actually seeing quite a lot of growth. What are you expecting to see across the Australian landscape?
Aquaculture is a very exciting industry. It's grown very rapidly, and I think it was 2 years ago, the contribution of fish in the world's animal protein diet exceeded red meat for the first time. And this is because it's a very popular source of protein. And in Australia too, we've seen an amazing growth of the salmon industry in Tasmania, the prawn industry in Northern Australia. Other industries like barramundi and abalone are also gathering pace and exporting, particularly into Asian markets. There's another really interesting opportunity as well. And much of the cheap cuts of white fleshed fish that we can purchase in our supermarkets, most of that comes from overseas. It's produced in countries like Vietnam and Thailand. In fact, 70%, would you believe, of Australia's domestic fish consumption is imported. And there's a big opportunity there for our aquaculture sector to replace those imports with homegrown species that we will enjoy to eat.
What about plant-based alternative proteins? Where do you see major growth areas there in Australia?
So it's small still, but again, a very rapidly growing opportunity. If you actually look at the global opportunity, the red meat industry globally is worth something like $1.3 trillion. So it's a massive, massive industry. Opportunities for plant-based products to substitute for meat in those markets is currently very, very small. It's only, you know, something like 1% or something like that. But the forecasts that the economists are giving are saying that it will grow rapidly. And we think with the demand for protein from many markets now, there's actually room for both growth in animal protein demand and plant protein demand.
How are you expecting the format of agriculture to change in Australia, but also across the globe, given that there is a real risk of climate change?
We'll see patterns of farming changing. So what we produce in dry areas will change as farmers have to adapt to less rainfall and hotter temperatures. We'll see also changes in the wetter parts of where farming occurs as well, because as less rain occurs there, options will open up for growing a different mix of things and running a different mix of animals on farms as well. So we're going to see some broad shifts of farming across the globe. And by the way, people often don't understand that not everywhere in the world is going to dry like we're predicting Southern Australia will. In fact, in some parts of the world, we're going to get wetter. And we often see that in looking at what's happening in the weather patterns in countries like China, for example. So China's predicted to actually become a wetter country as a consequence of climate change.
Given the environmental changes that will be seen, but also a change in consumer trend and the food that they want to see, how has that changed your research priorities at the CSIRO over the past 20 years?
Certainly our focus in terms of our food processing, food manufacturing work has changed more to align with these sort of trends that we're seeing, particularly in industrialised countries. So this interest in healthier foods, this interest in alternative products, particularly around protein. There's an interest in probiotics, nutraceuticals, those sorts of things. We're also doing work on how to convert waste that we see a lot of in agriculture into valuable products. So turning, for example, the sorts of waste you see on vegetable farms, where they leave a lot of produce behind in the field because it's not suitable for marketing. Turning that perfectly good produce that's just not fit for supermarket shelves because it maybe it's misshapen or not quite the right size, turning that vegetable matter into high-value products, including health products. So that you can see all those sorts of things are really quite different to the more, I guess, standard commodity-type work we would have done a few years ago. We were focused more on the processing technologies used in food manufacturing.
Some interesting ideas there from CSIRO Agriculture and Food Deputy Michael Robertson, who was speaking with Jessica Schremer. Not late today. So while we're talking CSIRO, they're also developing new medicinal cannabis products after being granted a federal cannabis manufacturing licence. The licence allows Australia to expand its share in the global medical cannabis market. And Professor Peter Duggan says the CSIRO has actually been working with botanical extracts since the late 1940s.
We've been granted this licence that allows us to work with medicinal cannabis and to develop new products, working with industry to do that. Presently, a lot of the companies are focused on the growing side of cannabis and producing the crop. And there's a lot of steps that are involved from when you harvest the plant through to getting a medicine to the patients that doctors can prescribe. And those medicines are in all sorts of different formats. So we can help Australian companies to develop those medicines, and then they can either manufacture them themselves or have toll manufacturers manufacture them for them.
So before we get into the manufacturing side of things, I'd just like to take it a step back. How hard is it for farmers to actually get approval to grow cannabis?
They need a licence from the Federal Office of Drug Control, a cultivation licence, and that is, yeah, they have to jump through a lot of hoops in order to be approved by the Federal Office of Drug Control for that.
So with this new licence, in what medical way will we be able to move the industry forward?
The first step is usually an extraction process. So there are various different ways that can be done. So we can help companies develop their extraction methods if they don't already have those. After that, you get a concentrated extract, and then that can be formulated in all sorts of different ways. So currently, the common way medicinal cannabis is delivered is in a vegetable oil, like coconut oil. And that's a pretty low-tech method, but that's like the simplest way of delivering it. And turning that concentrated extract into other formats, like wafers or lozenges that you put in your mouth, into beverages, or other interesting delivery methods like transdermal, delivering the cannabinoids through the skin, or intranasal delivery. And also CSIRO has a long history in slow-release technology that's more high-tech, but that can help provide a good constant level of cannabinoids in the blood if the technology is developed properly.
So with medical cannabis products, regardless of the form that they're in, what illnesses are most targeted by this sort of therapy?
There are actually a huge number of diseases that are targeted around the world, but the Therapeutic Goods Administration has recommended that there are certainly a small set of conditions that they believe medicinal cannabis can help with. And epilepsy, especially in young people, has already been investigated and is being investigated now in Australia. But other things include nausea and vomiting associated with chemotherapy. And a big one is chronic pain. There's a number of people seem to get benefit from cannabis when treating chronic pain. That may or may not actually reduce their pain, but it seems to improve their overall quality of life. And associated with that, palliative care is another one that medicinal cannabis is considered for. But the TGA also has recommended that it may work with multiple sclerosis as well.
Now, it's projected in the global market that medical cannabis could be worth up to $44 billion in US terms by 2024. Does this new licence mean Australia can invest more in becoming part of that market?
Yes, yes. And our companies are already exporting, and they're aiming to improve their exports to places like Europe, Germany, UK, France, and places like that. And there's also considerable interest in looking at Asia as it gradually opens up to medicinal cannabis. But what they're mainly exporting at the moment might be dried flowering head or this extract in oil. And there's a lot more value to be made out of developing these other formats. So there's a real value add that Australian companies can do if they can produce these medicines in these other formats.
CSIRO scientist Peter Duggan speaking with Jane McNaughton there about the development of new medicinal cannabis products by the CSIRO. That's just about all we have time for. John from Wallaroo has the hot tip, pun intended, that if you do have chilies, have a glass of milk on hand. Still don't think I'll be trying them, John, but stick around. It's coming up to 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.